Hello and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, this is our last episode of the season, belatedly. How are you feeling?
Relieved and super as always. I mean, when am I not feeling that way?
You know, Sean, every time that summer rolls around, I think to myself, sometimes the snow does come down in June. Sometimes the sun goes round the moon.
Just when I thought our chance had passed, we went and saved the best for last.
It's true. So much have we saved the best for last. Surely the best book that we've read of all the 12 books, wouldn't you say?
Well, no, I wouldn't, actually.
This slim, best-selling volume by Robert James Waller, which is called
The Bridges of Madison County.
Yes. Now, so The Bridges of Madison County, which we are both about to watch, you have not seen the film. Have you ever had any interest in watching the film in the past, or is it just one of those mid-90s movies that you've written off?
Well, to be honest with you, I know that they consider the 90s to be Meryl's kind of fallow period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody had ever said that The Bridges of Madison County was good or bad to me, and I never kind of...
Except me!
Except you, of course. But what I'm saying is, I got to my adult life having never met you without seeing The Bridges of Madison County.
More fool you. lucky you. Did you ever have an inkling of a notion about this book?
No, I'm sure I saw it in a family member's house. Well, see, my mother likes to... The books get passed around between aunts and mother. Is that right? Aunts and mother? A colony of ants. Books get passed around between my aunts and my mother, who all live in a similar geographical area.
The same street.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but this is surely not the kind of book that your mother would read.
You know, my mom's not a snob, okay?
I know she's not a snob, but she has taste.
I'll text her after this. I wouldn't be surprised if she just read that because someone put it in front of her, you know?
And what would her one-sentence review of this book have been?
I was fine.
Well, I have to say, so in the 90s, I did two things that were related to books. Two jobs that I had that were related to books. One, I worked in a bookshop for a summer, Borders Bookstore in downtown Boston.
Borders came to Ireland during the boom time and closed down. Nobody went to it.
Well, as you know, right outside of the Borders in downtown Boston is one of the most memorable Irish sites, the Irish Famine Memorial.
Oh.
You remember? We went by it. With the statue of the people who look like they're starving, and there's all those potatoes around, and then on the other one, they're striding forward to a fascist future. I spent afternoon... Do you remember it?
They look like people, don't they?
Yeah, they look like people.
Because our famine memorial in Dublin, in Ireland, they're just kind of like stick people, you know? Like, they have the illusion of being people.
They're abstract.
Yeah, that's the word, yeah.
Yeah, abstract. I think most memorials are better when they're abstract. Just talk to Maya Lin. Anyway, what was I saying? Borders Bookstore. I worked there one summer, and so I'm very well-versed in a particular period of time knowing what books were bestsellers kind of in the mid to late 90s because people would come in and be like, oh, I heard about this on Oprah. Where can I find it?
Let me guess. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil?
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Wally Lamb, all these books that people don't remember anymore. I'm pretty sure, however, that The Bridges of Madison County was before my summer at Borders, but I did have another job. I was an intern at the local newspaper, the Patriot Ledger, in the culture section, of course, and that was where I wrote my famous movie review of Trial and Error, starring Michael Richards, in which I singled out a young Jennifer Coolidge as a memorable actress, and Jennifer Coolidge's mother wrote a letter to the paper thanking the reviewer.
Aww.
I know. I also reviewed a local Quincy theater production of Marvin's Room, the play.
Yeah, I know it's a play. Who was in it?
Oh, local actors.
Okay.
Yeah. We're going to cut that bit out. But when I was working at the Patriot Ledger, in addition to receiving fan mail from character actresses' mothers, one of my tasks was to compile the list of local best-selling books because the standard bestsellers were like across the whole country, Whereas the editor had the great idea of, what if I call all the local bookshops and find out, you know, which books actually sold well in the South Shore of Massachusetts? So I had to like ring them up and ask them what was selling well. And I'm pretty sure that that was around the heyday of The Bridges of Madison County.
Like, it was still selling after the film?
I'm pretty sure. Well, it would have been, yeah, around the time the film came out. Yeah.
Were you 16 in 1994?
I would have been 15, yeah. I was 15, going on 16,
yeah, you're 79.
Innocent as a rose. Yeah, that's me. So, The Bridges of Madison County, when it came out, it was this phenomenon. If I said to you, who do you think is the quintessential reader of this book? What kind of person, like, ran to the bookshop to pick up The Bridges of Madison County?
Women in their 40s, I'd say.
And why is that?
Because it's about a woman in her 40s who is married with children and has, you know, a life. Nothing bad is happening to her. And then something amazing happens to her, something extraordinary, a love affair.
Well, at least nominally amazing.
Well, I think it's amazing.
If you haven't already detected, ladies and gentlemen, my reaction to reading this book after so many years is entirely predictable scorn. I found it laughable. Sean's, however, seems to be surprisingly sympathetic. Did you actually find your heart tugged by the story of farm wife Francesca Johnson and the rugged Robert Kincaid?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, okay, let's be honest. The writing is pretty dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's pretty shocking in places. We will read from the book, so dear listeners, your ears shall be lacerated within mere moments. But I just really felt for the character. I love these stories about opportunities that come into your life that you cannot take. Francesca Johnson, you know, this person, Robert Kincaid, comes into her life. He gives her an exit, you know, to leave life and to embark on something new, and she cannot take it. And I really connect with these characters who feel that they are trapped in a perfectly serviceable but deathly paralysis.
Do you relate to your own like rural existence? I mean, I know you didn't grow up on a farm, but you must have grown up Near some farms.
Yeah, no, here's the thing, is that Francesca Johnson could have been any woman in my local area. Let's just put it that way.
Except for the fact that she's Italian and not Irish.
If she were Polish, that would be possible.
There's some Polish
farm women
living in Ireland.
We had plenty of Poles in...
Thank God for the EU.
I know, eh? But here's the thing, she's worried about people seeing her or mentioning things about her or gossiping about her. And like, the whole thing is that when an opportunity comes into your life for something exciting and something amazing, you can spend your time worrying about what other people will think. But we do.
Mm-hmm.
And though you might find peace in the rural countryside, in many ways you have to give up your privacy when you live in a community where everyone knows your business.
Because, for instance, if a long-haired vegetarian hippie in tight Levi's happens to drive up in a broken-down pickup truck and park outside your barn, the neighbors will talk.
The neighbors will talk because it gives them something to talk about.
Let's give them something to talk about. Exactly. Can we just briefly, and I'm sure this will only take 17 seconds, can you just tell everyone the plot line of The Bridges of Madison County?
Okay, well, I knew you were going to ask me this. When I started reading this book, there was like an introduction or something, and I said to you, do I need to read this? Can I just skip it? Okay.
But it's not actually an introduction.
That's the thing. Yeah,
by an editor. No.
It's not at all. So basically, this is a true story, Francesca Johnson and Robert Kincaid.
Is it?
Yeah, it's true.
No, it is not.
It's based on extensive diary entries.
I think you've fallen prey to a metafictional canard, a ruse.
No.
Robert James Waller is second only to Jorge Luis Borges for his nested narratives and intertextual devices.
Oh, stop talking.
What? Okay. No, honestly, that is not real.
Can I just tell them what it is first?
Yeah, tell them what it is.
It's a preface in which the author inserts himself into the story. The children of Francesca Johnson come to him with evidence about the love affair between her and Robert Kincaid. And this is where it gets weird and daffy from the moment it begins. They say to him, here's something that might interest you in a story, and they're quite emotional about it. And they say, either turn it into a story or never tell anybody about it, okay? And if those are the options, it's like, you really don't want me to keep it to myself.
So can we just pause for a minute? So basically, here we have two adult children who have discovered that their relatively anonymous Italian war bride mother in an Iowa farm community had a 4-day affair with a National Geographic photographer, yeah? So if you find this out about your mother, what's your immediate response? Is your response to go track down a novelist and, like, basically force him to turn it into a novel?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, probably not.
Yeah, it's probably to be like, why did my mother never tell me anything about
this? Here's the thing. It's like, I think when you get older, you kind of think, well, if my mother did do that, would I hold it against her?
Well, no, of course not. Especially if your father
she's still
was
living.
especially if your father was, as represented by Richard Johnson in the book, like a kind of
as dull,
as
is it?
Dull, you know, sort of vaguely misogynistic and thick as paint as the farmer who is represented here in the book.
Yeah, poor Richard Johnson, who we only meet for like a minute. We're not told he does anything particularly bad, really.
Well, he definitely does not like the Beatles' long hair on the Ed Sullivan Show. He does not have sex very often. He doesn't drink. And the highlight of his year is taking the prize steer to the state fair with the kids.
Hey, that sounds like a good husband to me.
Yeah? That's the kind of husband you like?
Yeah, doesn't drink and doesn't want to have sex. Perfect.
More in love with beef. I guess I just want to pause for a minute at what while you're saying about the frame narrative. There is something, I think, ridiculous about a slim, essentially trashy romance novel building itself up. Does it seem as singular as that introduction kind of sets it up to be? Or does it just seem like yet another bored housewife and a sexy stranger comes to town kind of narrative?
Well, yeah, but I still like it. Because yeah, if you just chopped off all the extraneous elements of it, you get a love story about someone who had a dream for a moment that was unfulfilled. Is it monumental? No, but is the story genuine and sincere and romantic and passionate? Yes, I actually did like it. I liked the story. I hated a lot about it.
Like what?
Like the writing, okay? You quoted a passage from me, and it was something like that she could smell the wood smoke off his shirt, okay? I was like, that's not too bad, okay? And then it goes on and on and on.
Shall we?
She could hear the train pulling out of the station. Okay, let's read this part. Just
let it be said, of course, this is a romance novel, so you're waiting until Francesca Johnson and rugged photographer Robert Kincaid will actually start shtupping, you know? And having never read a romance novel, how is the language going to be described? Is it going to be one of those, you know, his pulsing manhood entered her Mons Venus? You know, I don't know. Instead, this is what we get.
Mons Venus.
With her face buried in his neck and her skin against his, she could smell rivers and wood smoke, could hear streaming trains chuffing out of winter stations in long ago night times, could see travelers in black robes moving steadily along frozen rivers and through summer meadows, beating their way toward the end of things. The leopard swept over her again and again and yet again, like a long prairie wind, and rolling beneath him, she rode on that wind, like some temple virgin, toward the sweet, compliant fires making the soft curve of oblivion. And she murmured softly, breathlessly, "Oh, Robert, Robert, I am losing myself." She, who had ceased having orgasms years ago, had them in long sequences now, with a half-man, half-something-else creature. She wondered about him and his endurance, and he told her that he could reach those places in his mind as well as physically, and that the orgasms of the mind had their own special character. I mean, come on, Sean, does that, like, even if you are a bored suburban housewife in a book club in Paramus, New Jersey, do you like that paragraph?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I do or not. I mean, I personally hate it, but maybe someone in Paramus, New Jersey, or Scottsdale, Arizona, or Boulder, Colorado, you know, connected to it.
Maybe Dubuque,
Iowa.
Maybe that's the guy. Dubuque.
Dubabadook, Iowa.
So basically, who is Robert Kincaid? Like, he's a photographer, but what kind of man is he? What kind of lover?
He's an introverted man, outdoorsy, and completely his own person. He has tight, sinewy muscles, and he's a nice, round, firm, small buttocks.
Yep. He also, and this feels crucial to me, is a vegetarian. Like, essentially this book could be a sort of crypto manifesto for vegetarianism, because the husband and the kids are off to, like, kill the prize steer, you know, at the state fair. It takes place in the 60s, right? And in comes hippie into his shaman chakras and Indian spirituality, Robert Kincaid. And he's like, oh, I'd never eat meat, you know, Francesca. I just love a good bean soup and some bean sprouts.
Yeah, but here, haven't you ever... Okay, I'm thinking of someone that I had a little thing with.
Uh-huh. Okay?
You'd smoke a few joints, and then you'd kind of, like, look into each other's eyes and talk a whole load of, like, hippy-dippy bullshit to each other.
Yeah, well, when we're talking about hippy-dippy bullshit, they quote Yeats back and forth to each other and other forms of poetry. Okay, so Francesca Johnson has grown up in a small Italian village, and after World War II, she's married Richard, who was a U.S. serviceman over there. But, like, is there any indication that she is actually an Italian woman, as she is depicted in this book?
Well, considering that she goes to the state liquor store and has no idea about wine...
Yeah, she's literally like, Valpolicella. Somewhere I remember that name from the hazy mist of my memories.
Yeah, so no, she doesn't.
No, she doesn't. But she's like quoting Yeats back and forth.
She is an English teacher.
Yeah, no, I know she's become an English teacher, but I'm just saying, like, couldn't he have just thrown in a little bit of Dante or something? Like, honestly,
yeah,
like,
he could have.
Okay, now just, we don't have to read any more of the turgid passages, but I want you to read this line, which, honestly, it gets repeated again and again, and probably like 3 or 4 times in the book, as if it's some sort of, like, incredibly memorable quotation.
Oh, yeah, that one. Robert, when we were making love last night, you said something I still remember. I kept whispering to you about your power, and my God, you have that. You said, I am the highway, and the peregrine, and all the sails that ever went to sea. What?
No, first of all, so you're in bed with the man, and he says, I am the highway.
Bearing down on you, you know?
I am the highway, and the peregrine. You'd be like, the peregrine? What the fuck is a peregrine? Isn't that a bird? It's a falcon.
What's a peregrine?
Peregrine falcon.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's like, my God.
You truly didn't grow up on a farm, did you?
I'm just saying, I mean, this book is dreadful.
But you know what is good? Your Marginalia, actually, is pretty good.
It's the kind of book that you just need to write bitchy marginal notes in just to, like, allow yourself to have some form of venting the commentary.
Here's one, just a random. She bought 2 bottles and another decanter of brandy, feeling sensual and worldly, to which Brian wrote, ugh.
U-G-H.
Yeah.
And there's another point where Francesca confesses her affair to her children in a posthumous letter, and talks about how much she loved, like, making love to Robert Kincaid. What did I write?
You wrote TMI, Mom.
Okay, so, Sean, you clearly, something about this book, you know, strummed your heartstrings, or maybe gave you a slight stirring in the genitals.
No, give me no stirrings in the genitals, but it did tug my heartstrings, because I had to imagine the people whom the book was written for reading it.
I can only assume that this epically long time that this book spent on the bestseller list, they particularly released it in a very small edition so that it didn't look daunting to read. And it was very popular with kind of suburban book clubs and things like that, you know? So I think a lot of people who were not necessarily readers read this book. It was actually, I was reading, optioned as a movie even before it was published. It was optioned by Steven Spielberg's company.
Amblin.
Yeah, Amblin, Kathleen Kennedy. I don't know if they ever thought Spielberg himself would direct it, but then ultimately when it became like this huge bestseller, I think it's really interesting that it eventually became a movie starring and directed by Clint Eastwood, because at that point, Eastwood had directed a number of movies. Well, I guess he'd done Unforgiven.
The year before.
Yeah.
So he...
No, not the year before, but...
So this is the next thing he made after Unforgiven.
I think so, yeah. So he'd been a successful, you know, director known for his kind of masculine stories and westerns and things like that. I mean, I could understand maybe why he sort of fits the role of Kincaid, that kind of rugged loner sort of...
The Last Cowboy.
Yeah, Last Cowboy kind of thing. It's interesting that he decided to direct it himself. It's also interesting that he decided to cast Meryl Streep. I really feel that the characterization of Francesca Johnson in the book is incredibly thin and uninteresting. Like, if there's one thing I really hate about the book, it's how much time the narration and the prose spends swooning over Kincaid and talking about how amazing Kincaid is and how his philosophy is so incredible and his understanding of, like, you know, Sanskrit poetry and blah, 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 gag me with a dick. But, like, because particularly when it's written by a man, like, it's just ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? It's like Robert James Waller is doing some sort of fantasy self-identification of him being himself, the last cowboy that would, like, stimulate a woman who's never had an orgasm in decades. And I actually think Francesca is more or less a kind of a blank in the book. Would you agree with me?
No, I would agree with you, absolutely.
And she never sort of, other than deciding to stick with her husband and her kids and not run off to him to the River Ganges, you know, she doesn't really do much in the book.
No, she's passive. Things happen to her.
Yeah, I mean, she obviously, when he first comes into town,
makes that decision.
She makes a bold decision to kind of invite him over for dinner and then invite him back again and to have sex with him and all that. But she is not a rounded individual, which is kind of a missed opportunity because, like, an Italian war bride in a Midwestern farming community is an interesting character. But, like, this book and this prose, like, gives you no psychological insight to that. Would you at least agree that much?
I don't have to try and dispute that. I agree completely.
And yet, as I hope we are about to find when we watch the movie, my memory of this is that it is one of Meryl Streep's best performances. We've obviously talked about Meryl Streep many times on many podcasts, including our last mini episode, where you fallaciously?
Fallaciously me.
you inaccurately claimed that I, quote, hate Meryl Streep, which is not true. I'm just not a kind of, you know, Meryl groupie. I'm not a Meryl absolutist.
You think she's triumphalist, don't you?
She is approaching Stalin-esque levels of, you know, thought police that, like, if you don't consider her every single utterance to be the best thing any woman has ever committed to screen, you're somehow blaspheming.
Well, you and Trump now have something in common. you can peruse the Academy of the Overrated together, hand in hand.
Van Gogh. Anyway, but I actually think The Bridges of Madison County is one of her best, and one that, you know, not that many people talk about today. The 90s were a period, I think,
mid-90s in particular.
Yeah, the sort of late 80s, mid-90s. I mean, we've talked about Meryl with her turn to comedy when she did movies like Defending Your Life and She-Devil and Death Becomes Her. We've done The River Wild in past seasons. She didn't have tons of box office success. She kind of went through a period of not getting as many Oscar nominations from the late 80s until this resurgence in the 90s. I assume it was when her kids were growing up. So I assume this was Mamie Mummy time and not movie time for Meryl. The quality actress who was getting most of the Meryl roles during that brief interregnum was
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson, right? And this year of the nomination for The Bridges of Madison County was also the high water mark of Emma's Oscar run, where she won the Screenplay Award for Sense and Sensibility and was also nominated for Best Actress. Then there's a kind of passing of the torch back to Meryl. You know, she kind of went into the next phase of her career. And I really think that her portrayal of Francesca Johnson, in my memory, it is this very un-Meryl-esque type of role, at least un-what Meryl was.
So do you remember the other actresses nominated that year?
It would have been Emma Thompson, Sense and Sensibility. It's got to be Susan Sarandon for Dead Man Walking.
Okay.
Elizabeth Shue for Leaving Las Vegas. Meryl, Emma. And who would the fifth one be? Oh, I just Googled it. You know who the fourth one, or the fifth one is?
Who?
Sharon Stone, Casino.
Oh.
But no, honestly, that's a great lineup.
Yeah, that's a great lineup.
Meryl, Emma, Susan Sarandon, Sharon Stone in her one Oscar nomination, and Elizabeth Shue in what really is a great role. You know, I think for me, seeing that movie in the theaters, I was not yet in the cult of Meryl. I'd probably seen Out of Africa. I'd maybe seen Sophie's Choice and not been all that impressed. I'd seen Kramer versus Kramer. So, like, it's not like I thought she was bad, but I think there was something about what she does on screen with the kind of relaxed physicality and sensuality and this kind of Mediterranean quality that I was like, oh, I've never seen this waspy-looking woman do this before.
I know everything Meryl did since then. Maybe then I'd be a bit dubious as to how she was going to play this. But we've seen her do comedy and lightness and
but
romance.
Name for me a adaptation. Film that Meryl Streep is a romantic heroine with sex scenes in it.
Adaptation, she has a thing...
That is not a romantic film.
Okay, but she has sex with...
Okay, but it's comedy. I'm just pushing you. Like, name a film, a romance movie, where Meryl...
Mamma Mia?
No, this is what I'm saying. Like, this movie stands out. Do you know what I mean? Like, can you think of it, like, the poster would be Meryl and a man, like, in an embrace or staring at one another.
She embraces Peter Strathairn at the end of The River Wild.
You're pushing it, Sean. You're really... Like, she doesn't do these kind of movies, is what I'm saying. She's not, like... I don't know who does these kind of movies.
Everyone else.
Yeah, I guess. Like, the typical kind of, like, woman full of romantic longing.
She does have that thing with, what's his name, in Postcards from the Edge.
Sean, okay, but, like...
She gets married to Bruce Willis and becomes her.
Out of Africa, right? Her and Robert Redford. But like, you know...
No, you're right. You're right.
Here she is embodying this role that is all about sensuality and heartbreak and longing, which like she has many wonderful strings in her bow or her violin, but the music of her heart is not necessarily something that she like plays on all that much, Gloria Estefan. This is also a Clint Eastwood movie, and I know we're about to watch it, but, like, what is your general take on Clint Eastwood? When the latest Clint Eastwood movie hits theaters, are you like, oh yeah, Jersey Boys, I can't wait, I'm gonna rush out and see it.
Oh, I forgot you did that, I wouldn't mind seeing that. Okay,
J. Edgar.
Clint Eastwood is an accomplished director. His political opinions are not to my taste.
No, I mean, they're basically the equivalent of an empty chair, if you ask me.
You know, but the thing is, do I think, oh, here's another Clint Eastwood vanity project coming? No, I don't. I saw Million Dollar Baby when it came out in the cinema. I wasn't the only one to like it because it got all those Oscars and stuff.
Yeah, A.O. Scott and Manola Dargis put it on the 25 best films of the 21st century.
Well, maybe we need to see it again.
I mean, it's a competent kind of melodrama. I mean, he's a classical Hollywood filmmaker. You've got to give him that, right? Like, in the sense that he focuses on story, he's not overly...
Story
and character. He's not overly, you know, ostentatious in how he directs things. I think there's a, like, Hemingway-esque kind of mythos to him as a filmmaker. You know, supposedly, he's famous for doing almost no takes. He makes his movies really quickly, kind of just, like, trusting that the first things he gets from actors will be spontaneous and fine and simple and pure. I mean... He's made a lot of dud movies, I think, particularly recently. Well, actually, when I was at your house for Christmas in Lanesboro, you were down at the pub or something
on
St. Stephen's Day, and I was at home because, I don't know, maybe I drank too much the night before.
You'd had a little bit too much Irish revelry.
Yeah.
And were getting creeped out.
And so I decided to turn on the TV, and that's when I caught a bit of J. Edgar. Oh my God, like that movie was execrable. Judi Dench as his kind of weirdly repressive homophobic mother, I couldn't deal with it. And Mystic River, I mean, there's just a bunch of Clint Eastwood movies that I would just, you know...
Prefer to forget.
Yeah, I would rather like drink K-O-Pectate than be forced to watch them again. But I really think The Bridges of Madison County is a beautiful, emotional, and surprisingly feminine film. That's my memory of it.
And when did you last see it?
Oh, years ago. I have seen it more than once. I saw it when it came out in the theater.
The
whole family went to see it. It was in Quincy, Massachusetts, in a theater that's now, sadly, gone. But so much of Quincy has been razed to the ground.
The earth scorched.
But I've watched it maybe once, maybe twice on a VHS since then. I really used to call it one of my favorite movies, and definitely I consider it one of my favorite Meryl performances, but I haven't seen it in years.
Great, so let's just watch it now.
Well, just one last question. Do you think there will be any attempt to do the framing device?
I hope not. I think it might work for a book, but you have to show a certain amount of artistry if you're adapting it to screen. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea, okay?
You just want it to be a straight-up kind of love story.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Is there any supporting cast that I should know
about? No, this is what's interesting. Like, particularly if there's no framing bit. Like, you just essentially have them in the bridge, like, in a room, in a kitchen, in a bathtub, in a bed. Like, yeah. There's not much to this story. Like, okay. Do you think it's going to be able to sustain a feature-length film?
I know it does.
You know it does.
Okay. I really want to like this.
Okay.
Because I didn't hate the book.
Okay.
We'll just see.
Well, let's get our minestrone vegetarian soup and a nice glass of Valpolicella, because it is time to cross that bridge.
Once in every life, someone comes along. And you came to me. It was almost like a song. You were in my...
And you like living here in Iowa, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm not gonna tell anyone.
What I'm supposed to say? Oh, it's just fine. It's quiet. The people are real nice. And all that's true, mostly. It is quiet. And the people are nice. Mm-hmm. In certain ways. You know, we all help each other out. If someone gets sick or hurt, all the neighbors come in and they pick the corn or harvest the oats or whatever needs to be done. If you go into town, you can leave your car unlocked and let the kids run around. Don't worry about them. Yeah, there are a lot of nice things about the people here, and I respect them for those qualities. Well, it's not what I dreamed of as a girl.
John, let me just say, this kind of certainty comes but just once in a lifetime.
Or once a series. Which is indeed that we liked this film.
We liked it. We liked it. We really, really liked it. The Bridges of Madison County is a great movie. Do you agree?
Yeah.
I can remember going to see it in that aforementioned, now defunct movie theater in Quincy. And when the movie started, thinking to myself, oh God, I'm not going to like this. It starts with a kind of, there's no musical score, just a kind of blank Iowa landscape, and in come some really annoying people.
Oh yeah. So right? How it starts is, no at Clint Eastwood film or someone presents or names above the title. It just says, The Bridges of Madison County, and we see three annoying people and one executor.
The executor of a will. These three annoying people have driven up in a very 1994 minivan, and they're bickering and yammering, and from today's eyes, one of them looks an awful lot like Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
His name is Victor Slezak. I can only imagine that people who had come for the luscious romantic story of Robert Kincaid and Francesca Johnson, they were thinking, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, well, here's the first improvement of the book. It doesn't begin with Robert James Waller sitting in an armchair saying, welcome. The film you're about to see, blah, blah, blah.
The film you're about to see was written by me, the great poet of heartbreak.
The shaman of love.
No, there is no shaman of love. But who are these people, these annoying, yammering people?
These are the Johnson kids, the grown-up Johnson kids, who have since lost their parents, the mother in particular. The executor of the will is opening the safety deposit box to reveal...
a lot of stuff.
Secrets.
Yeah, many secrets. There's like a key... There's a medallion, there's some cameras, there's three notebooks, there's a letter, there's issues of National Geographic. Like, there's lots of sort of objects in this film that are invested with a kind of totemic importance. Okay, spoiler alert, we've already, you know, had the money shot. We've said we like this movie. But if I told you that the movie was going to have this framing device, I suspect you'd be like, oh, that's going to be a drag.
Well, a little bit, but I also know that they were going to soften as time went on, because initially the children, I think a lot of people would react quite poorly to the news that, one, their dead mother does not want to be buried by their father and wants to be cremated.
There's some great lines from the daughter-in-law, annoying daughter-in-law, who says, who gets cremated? I don't know anybody gets cremated. I don't even think it's Christian. Maybe it's an Italian thing.
Did she say anything about me in that will? Anything particular?
Yeah, she's really annoying.
Yeah, but she's there to be the lightness to these dour children.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a genius to realize that as Francesca's story unfolds on screen, for us, the viewer, that her children are going to go on a similar journey where they learn and have a journey of self-discovery.
Is this the sort of thing where, like, you could excise this? You know, like, for instance, I remember when you and I watched A League of Their Own, right? Could we deal with the, like, aging Gina Davis characters and the, like, Hall of Famers, you know, kind of looking back on their glory days?
The only reason we couldn't deal with that was because they're different actors playing them, but they're dubbed over with Gina Davis's voice and things.
Well, but
so that's always a bit.
This is not that dissimilar, because I was thinking these two actors, like, oh, great, we get to play Meryl Streep's children in a movie. And then they look at the shooting scene and they're like, oh, we're never actually going to meet her. She's not in any of these scenes
because
she's dead.
You're right. She's not, is she?
No, she's not.
Wow.
So poor Victor Slezak's probably still never met Meryl. Yeah. She doesn't return my calls. It's not just like at the beginning and the end. We actually keep returning to the kids throughout the movie.
Well, that's also because otherwise you'd be stuck with Francesca and Robert Kincaid the entire time.
And you can't deal with that?
Well, I just don't think you need to. I think you need a little bit of punctuation.
Because as you pointed out when we were about to watch the film, you said, are there going to be any other characters in this? The screenplay has found a lot of ways to, like, build out the world slightly, and this framing device is one of them. So we do cut, and we join the kitchen in 1965, and there's Francesca listening to Maria Callas on the radio and cooking with the sensuality of her olive oil and her melanzana and making a delicious Italian meal for her, the young version of her children and her husband.
For her corn-fed children.
Yeah, they don't talk. They don't seem to have much emotion. They just come in and they just want to stuff their mouths full of grub while their mother is clearly sensitive and artistic, you know?
I thought it was a lovely family home.
Yeah, it is a beautiful home.
You have to say, okay, you have to, like, miss those days when all you had was one television set to sit around instead of everyone on different devices in different rooms of the house. It made me really long for the nuclear family.
So basically what you're saying is this made you want to move back to Longford and become a pig farmer.
Maybe not pigs, but...
Pig play.
Shut up, Brian.
Anyway, did you feel that there was a distinctive style to the filmmaking when we go back to the 60s?
Well, the distinctive style to the entire film is simplicity, and that is probably the nicest thing about it. Is that you get, okay, Meryl Streep's a big star, Clint Eastwood's a big star, okay, based on a very successful novel. And I think what I liked about it was that it is just a story of two people who meet and have a love affair. It never feels drawn out. The meat that the bones of the story are given are very beneficial to it. I love the framing device, because the kids, even though you don't really give a shit about them, they go on their own little journey, realizing that, wow, this person fundamentally changed her life, and now she is a person that we had never truly understood. Like, it's great.
As Meryl says in the narration, she says, "The older I get, the more I feel it is important to be known." In a funny way, the kids, as they read through their mother's diaries, they're not unlike the countless suburban reading groups, like flipping through and reading the book itself and, like, having their little discussions. You know what I mean? It's in a funny way, the whole thing is like a mirror of the people themselves, like, who first discovered the story.
And I think that's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, I have my heartstrings, like, yanked on.
Good. You've just melted all over the floor here in the room from the Bridges of Madison County.
No, but we mentioned this in the first half, is that I have a big connection to stories about people who are not given highway turnoffs in life. There's no exits. It's a very painful, mundane turmoil. These characters are just victims of that, the hand they've been dealt in life.
So there are no villains. Like, an interesting thing
is... This is a melodrama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what do you mean by that? We've said it before, but what do you mean by it?
Almost in the Cirquean sense, where it's not some kind of evildoer who's like... You know, tied Meryl to train tracks, and someone has. It's that this is tears and music and emotion, the domestic life, the world that you have gone into via marriage and the creation of children. You know, satisfies you in a way that you know you've left a legacy, but have you lived? You know, have you felt what it is to live?
And
those things really affect me.
I guess what you're saying is that this film somehow distilled. From what we pretty much agreed was the kind of really uneven quality of the original book. It distilled something that feels much richer, like it really reduced down to an amazing balsamic glaze, you know, or something like that, where the emotion was all that much deeper and enjoyable. What sort of aesthetic qualities would you describe to the way that Clint Eastwood and his filmmaking team have approached this work?
Well, it's quite unobtrusive. It's quite naturalistic. It moves at the pace of the characters' lives.
Which is quite slow and hot, summer...
Dusty.
Sort of... I kept coming back to the word dance, you know what I mean? They do spend long periods of time dancing in the kitchen and dancing at a nightclub, but also just the way that they come forward and away from each other, on the bridge, looking through the slats of wood, on the porch and in the car. There's a lot of kind of tentative, will they come closer, will they move further apart, watching and circling each other.
And you know the way when you're on holiday, time kind of slows down a bit.
Yeah, let's go to Iowa for our next holiday.
Oh my god, let's! But what I mean is that Francesca has 4 days without her family, and this 4 days becomes, you know, it becomes a film.
Yeah, and I agree with you. But why doesn't it become boring or tedious? Like, what is it that we're responding to and enjoying?
Well, Francesca is learning what exactly her feelings are, because it goes from, I have 4 days of peace from my family. Oh, who's this? Oh, you know what? I will get in this Jeep with them. Oh, no, I will have dinner with them. Oh, I will have a drink with them. I will smoke a Camel. To packing a suitcase.
Well, you skipped the important, you know.
Yes, they have S-E-X as well. But, you know, that, I just need to say that, Brian. But it gradually goes from one big decision to another.
Mm-hmm.
And that itself is a journey. Like, it feels genuine.
So I have to say, there's one person's name that we've not yet mentioned on the podcast. And it's, as far as I can tell, the only true Italian associated with this entire film. That man, a man that I've admired for many years, is screenwriter Richard Lagrevenese.
Oh, yes, of course. Now, director of P.S. I Love You.
Yes. He's got some of our favorite screenwriting credits under his belt. Things like P.S. I Love You, which I know Sean is a big fan of. Sean being a fan of Gina Gershon, me being a fan of Lisa Kudrow, and us both just dying for Hilary Swank. We love P.S. I Love You. But no, in all seriousness, Richard Lagrevenese is one of those 90s, like, really reliable craftsman screenwriter who, even as a kid, like, I noticed his name on things because I was like, oh, I kind of like that movie, Richard Lagrevenese. He did The Fisher King. He supposedly did a lot of work on Erin Brockovich, even though he's not credited with it. And then, of course, I mean, he's the mastermind behind Barbra Streisand's adaptation of The Mirror Has Two Faces. But I really think, like, what he's done to this book, a lot of those things that you're really saying work, those like slow steps along the way, that back and forth, probably more than any of the literary adaptations that we've looked at, I would say to you, the majority of the dialogue that they actually speak is not from the original book.
Oh, yes.
Did you find that to be the case?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because we talked in the first half about how Francesca in the book is barely even a distinctive character.
Yeah, it's much more focused on Kincaid.
Yeah, and when we say focused on Kincaid, it's like focused only to the degree that the prose is like puffing him up to this like mythic quality. And Clint clearly would be super uncomfortable with any kind of like shots that are really like making him, the body of Clint Eastwood, into this, like, love object, you know? Like, in a way, he seems like a normal, commonsensical, nice man. But I would actually say that what does get embroidered and flowered over is this blossoming, this opening up of Francesca. A lot of that has to do with Meryl Streep's performance, but it's also what Eastwood and LaGrivenese and she do to, like, make this woman into a character?
You cast Meryl Streep, who is a very capable actress, and you cast Clint Eastwood, who, although a very capable actor, is not showy, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Meryl is showy. Okay, not at this point in her career, but she's well able to dominate the screen. And so what happens is, you kind of say, okay, Meryl has the energy. You want to look at her more. You don't feel that Clint is being diluted.
He's like the still center. Yeah. He's this sort of rock, and she's this moth kind of like flying around and flitting and gesturing. Who is Francesca Johnson? The Francesca of the film is what?
So who is Francesca Johnson? Well, she's a good wife. She's grateful. She's simple. But she is passionate and emotional.
She lives a simple life, but I would suggest that, like, from the start, as she's cooking and listening to opera and, like, giving side eye to her husband and her kids and, like, looking at the dog, that we get all these bits of her that we don't get from the book. I don't know. Am I making this up?
No, you're not making it up at all. It's a small flame that wants to burn brighter.
Mm. She jokes with Robert Kincaid, right? Like, from the start, she's making sardonic remarks. She's remembering her youth in Bari, in Italy. Like, she's flirtatiously, slightly confused and kind of flustered by his appearance. And, like, all these things, like, gradually grow more and more until she becomes more comfortable in her sensuality. And I guess what I'm saying is, like, Meryl plays all that beautifully, but it's also the screenwriter giving her lines and things to play with, you know? It's giving her beats that just aren't there. Whatever he's done, he's, like, burrowed into her perspective. Like, this movie is really told from the wife's perspective, from the housewife, mm-hmm. from her role, you know? Well, we've been circling ourselves around Meryl's performance. Would you rank this up with her best?
You know, Meryl, even in Italian accent, has some Meryl qualities.
What are they?
I'll give you an example from Postcards from the Edge, okay? No, seriously, this is like Meryl's cadence down to a T. You remember where she's like, I don't care that you fuck around. I care that you lie about it, you know?
So that's Postcards from the Edge.
That's Postcards from the Edge. But even in this, like when Meryl has her speech about how Robert Kincaid doesn't understand her feelings, she does those Meryl qualities.
I'm not going to apologize for who I am.
Nobody's asking.
And I'm not going to be made to feel like I've done something wrong.
No, you're not going to be made to feel anything, period, because you have carved out this little part for yourself in the world where you get to be a voyeur and a hermit and a lover whenever you feel like it. And the rest of us are supposed to feel incredibly grateful for this brief moment that you touched her. Go to hell! It isn't human not to be lonely, and it isn't human not to be afraid!
I think these Meryl qualities really began in the 1990s. They begin in Postcards from the Edge and Death Becomes Her and The River Wild. And these four films...
Now a warning?
Yeah, these four films represent just a distinct change in Meryl's persona. It's like, even when I look at Meryl in 1980s films, she does have more of a kind of a glassy expression.
Mm-hmm.
She is more icy.
Mm-hmm.
And but when I think of Meryl in the 90s and now she's just like jello, you know? It's like, Meryl, you know, pull yourself together.
So considering the food metaphor, so from ice to jello, but here in the middle of this, I would say she's some sort of like slippery olive oil concoction. She's like a sun-dried tomato, like glistening in some
She's a caprese salad. Left out in the sun.
Yeah, I have to say, I think she does a marvelous job conveying longing and emotion and conveying this pain in this. It was interesting watching it again because for a long time when people would ask me, I'd say like, oh, Francesca Johnson, one of the best Meryl Streep performances, definitely. And I think I still probably believe that. But
you're always a bit critical of past opinion. I have to say I just would put it up there myself.
And I think the thing is like Meryl is always smart. Like she's pretty much always smart and sardonic and funny. And so like even Francesca Johnson, this simple housewife, she finds ways for her to make jokes and like there were some really funny lines. Like there's the bit where she's been giving directions to Clint to tell him how to get to Rosman Bridge, and she's like, you go down the road to this house, the one with the mean yellow dog, and then you turn left. And then later they see this dog running, and he's like, is that mean yellow dog? And she's like, yes. And he's like, looks white to me. And she's like, it's yellow. And it's clearly not yellow. And it's like these little, or he brings her a bouquet of flowers. And he's like, oh, I like it, but they're poisonous. And then he drops them. He's like, I don't know why I said that. And it just, like, you see her girlishness kind of coming out. And I just want to, like, yet again point out that all of that stuff, the yellow dog, the poisonous flowers, the jokes, his comedy where he's telling her about meeting a gorilla in Africa and she's laughing and kicking up her heels, none of that is in the book. Now, whether Meryl was involved in that characterization, I don't know. But he creates this woman who has these many sides of her. Or what about what she's started to, you know, have her eroticism unleashed? You love the bit where she's, like, alone on the porch after spending time with him for the first night. And what does she do?
Well, we discussed this. I mean, I don't remember. And maybe Michael Shulman, listener Michael Shulman, can back this up. I can't think of any performance or any film where Meryl has shown her body, but she...
Silkwood shower?
I haven't seen Silkwood, so I can't tell you.
In this, what does she do?
In this, she's sitting on the porch, and she just left her for the first time, and the summer night
she's
is
been
warm.
Reading Yeats.
And so what she does is she opens up her dress, you know, like, wide open.
The prairie wind blows through.
The prairie wind blows through, and we see, like, a hint of nipple. And I was like, oh my god, is that Meryl's nipple?
Now, it might be. Although I have to say, there's a couple other shots of her body. There's one where she's looking at herself in a mirror, and then there's another in a sex scene with an overhead shot where you definitely see her rear end. However, the way that they're cut, I think they're very clearly cut to be body doubles.
And a lot of people use body doubles.
Yeah,
you know.
It's perfectly fine. That's perfectly fine. Meryl doesn't need to show her butt for me to like her. but speaking of her butt, actually, as you pointed out, she does a lot of, like, slapping of her own butt, like, at different points.
When she meets him for the first time, she's walking away, and she kind of, like, smooths down her dress. What it basically does is it just, like, shows off her peachy round butt.
Yeah. So, and here's where I'm going to start to venture into a little bit of Meryl analysis, which some people may view to be hostile, okay? Now, how old was I when this came out? 16, right?
Yeah.
Revelation to me. I loved what Meryl was doing. I still have very, very high regard for it. However, in the back of my head, that nagging, you know, like a little gnat that's picking at you, it's the voice of persistent Meryl critic Pauline Kael, telling me that what Meryl does in any performance is combine a series of gestures into a characterization, okay? Now, and she points this out. She points out how in Manhattan, it's the way that she flips her hair. In Sophie's Choice, it's the way that she fingers the boa in her hand. And Francesca Johnson is a very complete characterization, but there is something about it that does have the air of a very, very competent drama student who has watched all the films of Anna Magnani, possibly also Sophia Loren, and has duplicated these, like, the way she walks with, like, one arm, like, slightly behind, the way she puts her hands in her pockets. There's this facial gesture stuff that she's doing that is, like, bonkers, where she just, like, puts both hands to her cheeks, and then she, like, reaches out, and it's like, there's a studied quality of, like, Italian-ness to the whole thing. I'm not saying it doesn't work, and I'm not saying that Francesca Johnson isn't a character that we feel for and that we like. But if you were to divide it up into little bits, we could play bingo with it. You know what I mean? Like, we would get drunk if we had a drinking game of every time Meryl puts two hands, two palms to both cheeks. Yes.
Do you remember in Tootsie, Jessica Lange? At nearly every single time she opens her mouth, she's kind of like, she's literally like rubbing her hand on her face. And it's like, or she's kind of like yawning where she like puts her, if I know this is radio, so you can't see what I'm doing. But
believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it's extremely sensual.
Yeah,
Sean is doing
it. And it's
right
kind of like, but I watch, this is why I still think Terry Garr should have got that Oscar. So I'm like, Jessica Lange just won it by like rubbing her hands all over her face.
You're diverting yourself from the subject because actually Jessica Lange won it by also being in Francis the same year.
Yeah.
But anyway. I mean, it's interesting that you picked that year, because isn't that the year she lost Meryl for Sophie's Choice?
Interesting,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, like, Meryl, in a way, has atomized this character down to these kinds of gestures, and you can almost see the calculus in her head that's like, if I begin with these gestures being slightly awkward, and kind of her batting away flies awkwardly and walking tentatively, and then we watch as this physicality blooms and blossoms and becomes more confident, when then we'll see the emergence of this character. And it's like, great, like, I agree with that. And it is very beautiful and individually lovely to watch. But there are times that I'm just like, if you can see all the work, like, that's good for a geometry exam. I don't know if it's good for a fully, like, embodied spontaneous performance. Okay, there I said it. That's it.
It's fine. I don't disagree. But isn't acting about gesture as well?
No, it is. But it's also obviously got to be at some level, if you're doing this kind of naturalism that's meant to seem like you're really the character, it has to also be about conveying a degree of spontaneity that calculation doesn't seem like it's been predetermined.
It's funny, you know, because Miranda Priestly is a character who I don't believe is ever spontaneous.
Well, see, exactly. And I would just argue that Meryl is such an intelligent actress that she is best suited to playing characters like that who are supremely intelligent. Like, now, to take the recent AFI winner, Diane Keaton, like, you don't watch Annie Hall and think, oh, Diane Keaton, like, predetermined every single pause and line reading and, like, eye flutter that Annie Hall has. Do you know what I mean? Or even Waiting for Mr. Goodbar or whatever. It just feels like this kind of natural, bubbly emergence of a kind of Diane Keaton-ness that's like responding in the moment. I think Meryl, and I hate to say it, like, even when she's like giving a speech about Hillary Clinton and her grit and grace at the Democratic National Convention, you just see her like prepping it in the room before. Okay, sorry.
Now you're getting a bit vicious.
I take it all back. Okay. I love you, Francesca Johnson. I love you.
Anything to say about Clint Eastwood while we're here?
You, at one point, there's a significant bit where they've gone back to the house, and she's looking out the window, and Clint Eastwood is washing himself off at the water pump or whatever that is, yeah? And that was the point where you turned to me and said, he's fit enough.
I don't think I said it so suggestively. I think I was like, he's fit enough. I can totally see it for Francesca Johnson.
Because?
Because he's not some corn-fed, meat and potatoes lump.
He's just like he's quite flinty and lean, really,
yeah,
in his body.
Yeah, I like a lean man.
He has really nice, on your biceps when you have, like, that one vein that goes right through the bicep.
Oh, really?
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Do I have it? Do you have it? Let me see. I mean, we all have veins going
through. Yeah, but I mean,
bicep.
Like, when you have quite a lean physique,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
You can kind of see that one vein there.
Oh, yeah,
it's not
lean,
like, yeah, do you know what I'm talking about?
I love those really lean fellas.
Yeah, he does have that. So you'd be a Robert Kincaid acolyte.
Yeah, but Robert Kincaid completist.
Yeah, but I guess it's interesting, like, the comparison. They play off each other well because, as you said, Clint really doesn't act. He's like, if I'm going to be laconic or emotional or upset or restrained, I'm literally just going to say every single line in the same way, which is to kind of just read it without any sense of emotion.
I've had people like that before,
yeah.
You know, who you know they're being genuine, but they don't, you know, wave their arms around.
Whereas Meryl is definitely waving her arms, right? Like,
you know who else waves their arms around?
We're Italian, darling. It's just what comes out, you know? So there's lots of gesticulation. There's lots of touching of face and signs of the cross and all sorts of flutteringness. So it does, in that sense, they create an interesting pairing. I hope I didn't come across as too critical.
Babe, you come across as critical about Meryl every time you open your mouth, and then you always backtrack. So it doesn't make any difference.
I just think, like, it's important to have these voices in the world, you know?
I know. And I know what your beef about Meryl is that we shouldn't be crowning this one actress over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree with you. And I also think people are completely blindsided by her, that they somehow think, because of this sense of royalty that's been bestowed upon her, you know, we're kind of blinded to think that, oh, well, maybe she didn't deserve this Oscar nomination for Florence Foster Jenkins, or doubt.
Doubt. I have such doubts. I have such doubts, Sister James. But to just dwell on this pairing of Eastwood and Streep for a little while more, it'd be interesting to imagine them on the set where Meryl is, like, constructing her Francesca of all these gestures, and Clint is thinking about these very clean, very basic kind of setups of the camera angles and all this. It really does work really beautifully. The two sequences that are, like, absolutely pure cinematic poetry, just on this, like, visual editing level, are the first sequence where they go to the bridge, and he's down in the kind of ravine setting up the tripod.
Yeah, and she's walking into the covered bridge, and she's peeking out of the gaps in it, and he always appears to be looking at her when she's there, and he knows where she is.
Sort of talking to each other through the bridge, but she's also looking, and she's walking in a kind of girlish, flirtatious way. And just the way that that's choreographed, the way that the camera has her in and out of the light and the shadow and him popping up in different places, it just captures this beautiful dance of flirtation that's going on with them.
Always this hot around here?
Oh, yes, this time of year, yeah.
There's some sodas in the back of the truck if you'd like one.
Oh, would you like one?
Oh, not right now, thanks.
I'll go get one.
This is why it's so visually, unobtrusively competent as well,
mm-hmm.
is that there are these flourishes which you may or may not even pay attention to.
And do you know the other sequence that I'm going to say is just, like, completely masterful?
I'm trying to think, actually, because I knew you were probably going to say that one to start, but...
The bit, if you had to take, like, one section of this film and preserve it in the Library of Congress, that is just, like, a masterpiece of editing and is, like, destined to pull the heartstrings, it actually takes place in the rain, in the car.
Oh, yeah. No,
do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. That's brilliant.
So explain what's happening there.
Is that after Robert Kincaid has said his goodbye and Richard Johnson has come back, Francesca and Richard go to the general store and pick up some things. And as Francesca's waiting for Richard to get back into the car, she sees Robert Kincaid standing in the rain. I was sitting there thinking, please, please, please don't mouth, I love you. And he doesn't, thank goodness.
He stands there in the rain. This is not in the book.
No, this part's not in the book. But then, is this part you're thinking of, or is it in the car you're thinking of?
Well, the whole sequence. Okay. But what I'm saying is, like, there's this moment where he's standing in the rain, almost seeming to say to her, get out of the car and, like, come and follow me. Then he walks away. He gets back in his car. His car is driving just ahead of hers and her husband's.
And there's this traffic light, red light, and this is actually kind of scary. If I was her, I'd be feeling ill in the back in the car, because he's in the car in front, and she's sitting with her husband directly behind. The light goes green, but he doesn't drive away just yet. Even before the light turns green, we see Francesca's hand very slowly grip the door handle and turn it.
As if she's almost about to, like, jump out of the truck and run into his. And he's also taken, do you remember, the medallion, the cross that she's given him, and he's hung it onto the rearview mirror, which she can very clearly see.
Yeah.
So even her oblivious husband is saying, like, oh, that must be that photographer guy who's come to town. And meanwhile, we're cutting back to, like, Francesca, who's, like, you know, her stomach is tied in knots and her heart is, like, pounding out of her chest, you know, as the rain is pouring and she's got her head on the handle. And I just feel like there's so much beautiful tension, and then cutting to the, like, intensity of the taillight on his car, like, flashing red, you know, kind of saying, are you going to make this choice?
I mean, I think anybody knows that she's not going to run, but she really wonders for a second what she's going to do. And after that, she cries, and her husband, being the oaf that he is like...
He's not an oaf, he's just
he's
like...
what's wrong, Franny? You want to tell me what's wrong? If I was Francesca, I would vomit. I'd go... and he'd be like, Jesus Christ, Franny, can you not hold it in? What's wrong with you?
Must have been all that Italian olive oil you were having while we were away at the state fair. No, honestly...
Too much affogato.
The thing is, like... Eastwood and Le Grevinese and Streep, they just understood what the book needed. The book needed a few more beats of tension. So, like, it additionally, they have a bit where Francesca and Robert are at their most romantic in the house, and then their neighbor, played by Tony Award winner Deborah Monk, comes over and interrupts her, and Eastwood has to hide in the bedroom. That's not in the book, right?
No.
So suddenly we get
although
this...
damn well it should have been. The entire time I was reading the book, I was like, when's the neighbor going to call
well,
over?
No, see, but exactly, and this is why Robert James Waller is just not very smart in terms of his narrative. He has so many long paragraphs about the peregrine and the prairie winds, and nothing about, like, the kind of tension in the choices, right?
Yeah. There's the fear. It's like, I'm in love in my own house, minding my own business, and now I'm going to have to suddenly stop because a neighbor, a prying eye is coming in who will carry word of my behavior to the townspeople.
I mean, also there's this sense that the Eastwood character has, he goes into the diner and he runs into that Redfern woman, who is also a construction for the movie, who's this other woman who's had an affair with someone outside of her marriage, and the entire town has shunned her. So it becomes this kind of like parallelism that we know if Francesca makes this choice to run off with Robert Kincaid, like what she and her family will face and how painful it is.
One of the most touching parts is that Francesca says that she can't leave, not just because it would hurt her family, but because the mockery of the townspeople, how they'd be shunned, how they'd be ridiculed.
She says they would never survive the talk.
Yeah, and that is so true, and that's so, so painful.
I think she's also very wise in the sense that she says, we have these 4 days, but if I go away with you now, the love that I feel now will start to become a reason that I hate the choice that I've made.
Yeah.
So, Sean, it's taken you all these years to see The Bridges of Madison County. When it was done, like, you were in an emotional reverie.
I just feel the feelings in that picture are very genuine and real, and a lot of people can relate to them. And they can transform those feelings and modulate them for their own experience. I actually think every gay boy from a small town watching that film can connect to it, because it's all about what other people will say about your behavior.
Mm-hmm. So,
not to queer it, but you know what I mean?
It's like, so Francesca Johnson is a queer analog.
Yes.
And here she has got, and sadly, her son grows up to be Ted Cruz. I mean, God. We were saying, weren't we, that like when he's young, he's super cute, the son, in his little farmer's overalls. And it's really funny because he actually kind of looks a bit like Paul Ryan when he's young, but he totally looks like Ted Cruz when he grows up.
Well, that's what happens to someone's face when they have those kind of feelings toward the world.
When they're trying to steal healthcare from a lot of other people.
Exactly. But you know, Paul Ryan does not deserve to be that handsome, you know? He really doesn't. I hope he ends up looking like Mitch McConnell. You know, in a matter of
like a dried up cartoon tortoise.
It's like you left a dead turtle out in the sun.
And on that note, well, it is a Clint Eastwood movie, yes. So I mean, fundamentally, this is quite a conservative movie, Sean. We have to admit, because even though you were saying like how wonderful it is that it validates like this kind of love and which is outside of social mores and affairs and all that.
Yeah, it's ultimately, also about what will happen to you and your family if you violate the social order.
And no one rebels against it, and we're supposed to like validate Francesca's choice for like her daughter and her son and her husband to like, you know, suppress her own erotic desires. So maybe it's not uncharacteristic that Eastwood would have constructed what is ultimately quite a normative plot outline.
Yeah.
But still, a movie that you would say is worth people seeing on a hot summer night with a loved one by their side.
Yeah, and Aperol Spritz in your hand, like I did last night.
All right, well, Shawnee, we've done it.
Well, just about.
No, really, we have gone through an entire season, 12 books about women, films about women. How do you feel?
Well, I feel relieved. I feel proud of myself. I'm also excited to read whatever I want now.
Yeah, I know, exactly. It's summertime, so you can have anything you want on your bedside table.
Well, actually, I recently picked up a book called Stalinism as a Way of Life. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is not a joke. That is, in fact, the book that Sean is reading right now.
Whenever I would start reading it before I'd finished The Bridges of Madison County, Brian would chastise me. So, I mean, back to freedom of choice.
Can I say, darling, if you're looking for freedom of choice, I'm not sure why you're reading Stalinism as a Way of Life. But anyway, I digress. So yeah, we can read what we want. It's going to be a few wonderful months of indolence and liberty. And we will be missing all of you. But have no fear. We'll be back soon enough, sometime in the autumn. Date TBA. And it's interesting, actually, isn't it, Shawnee Pye, that we had Clint Eastwood featuring in the last film of our season, because the new season is going to be somewhat related to Clint Eastwood, isn't it?
I'm actually racking my brain to see what the connection is.
A certain spaghetti western?
Oh, yes, of course.
No, so seriously, we've debated long and hard, how can we top ourselves? It's a question we ask nearly every night. How can we top ourselves? You know, we forced ourselves to read 12 books. We looked at the gays. We looked at women of the 90s. What can we do now? Well, all we have to say is we are going to be looking at a cavalcade of films. We will probably have to watch more films than we've ever watched before for a single series, and that means that there will be all sorts of content jam-packed into every single episode for you. We're going to definitely delve into some actresses whose careers we've never covered. We'll probably also return to some perennial favorites. So we're not going to tell you the exact format, but shall we give away the title?
Yeah, the title is going to be called Broad Appeal, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy.
So we'll leave that for you. We won't tell you what it is. We'll just let you swirl that around in your mouth a bit, taste the bouquet, see if it has legs, and then spit it out into a receptacle, because that's what you do at a wine tasting.
Oenophilia. Am I right?
Exactly right.
So in the meantime, you can listen to any of our perennial favorites, all on iTunes and Stitcher and Podomatic, where we host our podcast. They never age, so just jump right in there immediately.
What are those perennials? They're flowers, right? That just keep coming back again and again.
Yeah, hardy perennials.
Is it like geraniums? What's a perennial?
Well, a daffodil is a perennial.
Is it?
Yeah.
What's the difference between a daffodil and a jonquil?
I don't know. Ask Catherine Hepburn, she'd know.
The calla lilies are in bloom again.
And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Sean McGovern X. Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks. And Broad Appeal is at Broad Appeal Pod. Please tell your friends.
We better end this episode soon because I think I'm going insane.
This has more codas than the book, The Bridges of Madison County.
Shawnee Pie, you go off to Stalinism. I'll swirl some rosé. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in a few months with the good, the bad, and the crazy.
I'll see you, Brian, in a few months' time.
Arrivederci.
Bye.
That was good.